The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
All right, 4:30, yes, basic rhetoric. This is where we should be. And the good news is we should probably be done for dinner early. With both Wilson and Whitling speaking at the same time, I thought about hanging a sign on the door. Come in here, I'll let you out early, we'll all go to lunch early, and maybe we'd have an audience away from those two. Just out of curiosity, how many rhetoric teachers are here? Okay. Have you noticed, in general, during the conference here, how well have speakers been following the outlines in the book? Okay, so not so good. The reason why this is because they ask for the outlines in January. There is no way I know in January what I might want to say in June. So just on behalf of everybody who deviated from the outline, that's our excuse. Given that, I'm actually going to try and stay with the outline. But you will notice point number one on the outline is apologies. When I was creating this outline, I knew no matter what else I was going to say, I was going to have to apologize for something at the beginning. So I just put it down there, apologies. And then when I started going back with some detail and trying to figure out what exactly do I need to apologize for, I realized that my apologies would actually run the entire hour if I listed all the apologies. So I said, if I can't get them all done, why bother with any of them? I'm not going to apologize for anything. We're just going to start talking about rhetoric. So, with no apologies, consider this quote. If truth were self-evident, eloquence would not be necessary. That's a great rhetorician's quote. It sounds good. It sounds eloquent. It's short. It's attached to a name that is generally well-known or at least well-recognized. It's good stuff. Why are we doing rhetoric? Well, there it is. But what if we were to look somewhere else? Sincere words are not elegant. Elegant words are not sincere. Excellence is not winning arguments. Winning arguments is not being excellent. Understanding is not wide learning. Wide learning is not understanding. If we're honest, I think we could look at that quote as well and say, well, yeah, I can see, I can imagine some instances where that would be true as well. Fiddler on the Roof, one of the opening scenes with Tevye and the village and Perchik coming in and he's right and he's right. They can't both be right. And Tevye responds with, you are also right. You know, can they both be right when it doesn't appear that they're saying the same thing? So if we're going to talk about rhetoric at all, we're going to have to define some terms. And this is problematic. If you are a rhetoric teacher or an administrator that has ever fielded the question from a parent, well, what exactly is rhetoric class? And you have to say, and they say, really? And you spend 2 years teaching that? I could do that all by myself without that instruction. And you'd like to be able to say, look, have a seat, sit down, let's talk about this for an hour or so. And maybe we can come to some kind of understanding of rhetoric. A good classical rhetorician, which I am not. I'm not a speech communication major. That's not what I did. I did intellectual history. I did teaching social studies. I did political philosophy. I've done lots of things. The closest I ever came to studying rhetoric was doing a course in grad school on philosophy of language. I absolutely loved the course. It was fascinating, eye-opening, marvelous, wonderful, and I had to beg the professor to please let me out with a B-. So a good classical rhetorician, which I am not, would begin to trot out some definitions here from antiquity. If you've used the rhetoric curriculum coming out of Logos, you'll know this first one. Plato in the Gorgias talks about rhetoric being a sham of justice, a flattery, an imitation. Plato in other places will contrast the lawyer and the philosopher. He says, the philosopher stinks in the courtroom because he's after the truth. The lawyer excels in the courtroom because he just wants to win. He doesn't care about the truth. Famous definition. Isocrates, he doesn't make it, terribly important guy, but he doesn't make it to that level of Plato and Aristotle. But the power to speak well and think right will reward the person who approaches the art of discourse with the love of wisdom and the love of honor. Not very far from the good man speaking well idea. And we can kind of see that. That makes some sense to us. I'm sorry these are long, but it beats making photocopies. Then there's the Aristotle definition. The ability to, in any given case, perceive the available means of persuasion. I've had numerous students come back after they've graduated, gone off to college with a story similar to the following. Mr. Pitts, you'll never guess what happened on first day of Composition 101. The teacher got up there, and she's talking about this and that and the other thing, and she says, well, how many of you have ever heard of rhetoric? And I was the only one in the class that could raise their hand. And they said, oh, really? Well, maybe you could define rhetoric for us. And I stood up, and I popped out Aristotle's definition word for word, and I secured an A in that class on day one. Many, many times this has come back. This is a great classic definition of rhetoric. Cicero, one of those great names. The ability to speak in court, in the deliberative bodies, to prove, to please, to sway, or persuade, etc., etc., etc. The science of speaking well, says Quintilian. Augustine even throws his hat into the ring here. The universal task of eloquence in whichever of these three styles is to speak in a way that is geared to persuasion. These definitions are easy to come by. Google definition of rhetoric, and I think this website here, grammar@about.com, is the first one that comes up. These are easy to get to. Is that really what we're doing? Is that really ultimately what we want to do? Is rhetoric class nothing but a class on persuasion in courts and assemblies about the just and the unjust? If you dig around a little bit more, spend some time in rhetoric department websites. Look at some rhetoric department syllabi. Look for how is the word rhetoric used in the universities today. I've classified them in a handful of ways. The professors have not classified them this way. But we could look at rhetoric politically. It's a doing of something. The manipulation of men's belief for political ends. That doesn't sound so lovely. Oh, hi, what do you do for a living? Oh, I teach young, impressionable children to manipulate men's belief for political ends. You can't do that. If we wouldn't say it, why would we do it? Rhetoric is an instrumental use of language. Let's exchange some symbols so that I can accomplish something. Well, it doesn't sound nearly as nefarious, but it seems hardly something worth 2 or maybe 1 year of class in a Christian school. We would like to teach our children to coordinate their social activity by manipulations of signs and symbols. Well, haven't they been doing that since kindergarten, using signs and symbols to coordinate their activity? Okay, I'll be this, and you be this, and you play. They do it all the time. So, or is that what we're doing? Some university professors prefer to look at rhetoric as a scientific exercise. I am a professor of rhetoric, which means I study people who are talking. Is that what our rhetoric courses are all about? Are we studying other people's attempts at persuasion? Is the rhetoric class a scientific enterprise? We'll take some speeches, we'll take some sound bites, we'll take the latest and greatest off the op-ed pieces, and we will analyze them. We'll figure out what's being said, how they're saying it, and that's what rhetoric class is. I'm not sure we'd be comfortable with that either, although we probably do that. I do that. But is that what my class is? Is that what rhetoric class is? Are we just studying speech? I would say no. That's for later. By all means, some of your students should go on to do philosophy of language or semantics work in grad school. It's a great, wonderful thing. It seems to me that Christians ought to be leading the way in both physics and the philosophy of language. If we have any kind of special insight into light and word, it should be showing up in those fields. So study of language, great and wonderful, but really for the 16-year-old, is that ultimately what we are doing with rhetoric class? There are the pragmatists out there. And the pragmatists, you got to hand it to them. They really have something to this whole thing. Let's not dismiss pragmatism too quickly. I kind of like a lot of it. Then there's the whole sociological approach to trying to define this rhetoric thing, where ultimately we're asking, different cultures have different modes of speech. We understand our own particular speech patterns, and we might misunderstand somebody else's. I have lived in an area about an hour north of here that in many ways did not advance past the 1950s, and that is both good and bad. It has a quaintness about it. A small town America to the T. But many social interactions with the natives there, no idea what they're saying, and this is so embarrassing. I think we're speaking English. So there is that study of language that says, well, look, and Mr. Detweiler up here was just talking about this. It was great. Well, the Chinese language functions just a tad differently than the English, and as a result, they appear to be better mathematicians than we are. This idea of looking at how different cultures deal with language. It bears, I think, or at least I can justify delving a little deeper into this, into these two cultures. What has one to do with the other? We know the quote. It's a fabulous quote. It's been overused and turned into a cliche, but it's still a great quote. What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? And this brings up the question of what exactly is the difference? Is there a difference between a classical education and a classical worldview? And for those in the audience that might hate the use of the term worldview, I agree with you, but I'm still using it anyway. Are we trying to do one without the other? Are we trying to do both? I'll be perfectly honest. I am not trying to make my students Greeks and Romans. For me, the Greeks are pagans. The Romans are pagans. Lovely, lovely culture. Great buildings. Remarkable literature. Love a lot about it, but they're pagans. I do not want my students to leave looking at the world as if they were a Greek or a Roman. Our school mission statement, and I know it's a mission statement of lots of other classical and Christian schools, is, I really should be able to rattle this off, but it's something about an excellent classical education founded upon a biblical worldview. So this whole tension between biblical worldview, classical education. We're not saying I want a classical worldview and I'm going to do it classically. I'm going to make a bunch of little Greeks and Romans, and here's how they did it, so I'm going to do it. There is definitely a tension between these two models. Just as a quick aside, Erica Falk is one of those professors of language, writing in one of those very highly respected communication journals. And what caught my eye several years ago was the title here, Jewish Laws of Speech Towards Multicultural Rhetoric. Now, the beauty of this is that her article was basically saying, look, rhetorical studies have been dominated by Aristotle from the very beginning. And even today, in the universities, this defines rhetoric, this art of persuasion. And she says, there are other cultures that do not take persuasion as a defining factor in their rhetorics. And so what she does is says, here, let me lay out for you the traditional Jewish view on speech. Of course, the traditional view of speech that she lays out is entirely taken from the Old Testament, so it's absolutely lovely. And it actually gets into this journal because it wasn't written by an evangelical Christian. So it's beautiful to see this article in a major journal referencing nothing but the Bible, as she lays out and says, here in traditional Jewish culture, the word for word, devar, it means it's not only word, but it is a deed. It is something that you do. And very often we make much of the variation, the shades of meaning that can be had in the word logos. But we don't often pay attention to the Hebrew word devar that logos was standing instead of. And so this concept of, no, a word is an action. By it, worlds are created and people are destroyed. They are incredibly powerful things and they need to be treated with caution. And so she simply lays out from the scripture, what does the scripture say about talking? And she categorizes it in traditional fashion, along lines of prohibited speech and speech that is encouraged. You may not lie. You may not flatter. You may not slander. Lashon Hara does not have a good English equivalence. But Lashon Hara is speaking the truth that causes damage. You can speak the truth and still wound and destroy with it, and that is prohibited. Miriam's leprosy was the result of her speaking Lashon Hara against Moses. What she said was true, and God smote her for it. She wasn't supposed to say it. And then there are the types of speech that are encouraged biblically. Being brief, to the point, principles of parsimony ruling. What's a promise? The importance of promises. The importance of actually discussing scripture. The importance of rebuking properly. So she here lays out and says, the world can be understood through an Aristotelian lens. You can take Aristotle's rhetoric and apply it to any bit of speech you find anywhere. Is that always the best way to go about it? You can take Aristotle and read the scripture through the lens of Aristotle. Does that really give you the scripture? Is God using ethos, pathos, and logos, or are we simply identifying it in there and he's doing something else? I don't know, but there are serious questions here in terms of biblical worldview versus classical education. So, given these kinds of questions, really, it seems that with a rhetoric class, we can approach rhetoric as an art form to be developed. We can make it a public speaking course. We can teach our students to stand up behind the podium and to stand erect, look their audience in the eye, and be beautiful, wonderful, eloquent speakers. And there's not a thing wrong with doing that. We could take that as our principal approach to rhetoric. This is what we're going to do. Or we could look at rhetoric as the opportunity to evaluate other rhetorics. We could do it as kind of a sword and shield mentality. We are going to analyze how other people are trying to persuade you so that you won't be bamboozled. You know, we could take that as our guiding principle in a rhetoric class. Or we could paint with a broader brush and take the whole sayer's idea not more seriously, but maybe more at face value. What if rhetoric class was simply the ultimate polishing tool of the rhetoric school? The sayer's, when she wrote The Lost Tools of Learning, she was part of a much larger group of thinkers who were reacting to a trend in progressive education, which had come about as a reaction to the trend in the great bureaucratizing of education, which had come about as a reaction to the trend of the new modern subjects and the mess that they were making of everything. And the new modern subjects were, of course, a reaction to the Greek and Latin dominated education in the early 19th century. It's not that Sayers was original. She wasn't. But she was a really good writer. You can look around at this time, a dying breed of academics who were advocating a return to a liberal education. And there's a common thread running through all of them. Learning how to learn is one of them. Developing student autonomy is another. Getting students to think for themselves. They were looking at the progressive education that was being experimented by Deweyan disciples. And Dewey takes sometimes a harder rap than he deserves because of his disciples. Lord, save me from my disciples. Similar things happen. They're reacting against some rather silly educational ideas. And they're saying, whoa, no, this is not what we need. We are in a crisis of civilization here. We need something substantive. We need people. We need real people with backbones who think for themselves, who are not swayed by propaganda. This was a very real problem at the time they're writing. Just a couple of quotes here from Sayers when she's talking about the rhetoric stage. If we are to produce a society of educated people fitted to preserve their intellectual freedom amid the complex pressures of our modern society, we must turn the wheel of progress some 400 or 500 years. Emphasis mine, their intellectual freedom. This is part and parcel of the entire program that Sayers is laying out. It's not going back to a medieval syllabus for a medieval syllabus's sake. There was a very real purpose behind it, to preserve their intellectual freedom. When we read her writing, thirdly, he learned to express himself in language, how to say what he had to say elegantly and persuasively. Our tendency, I think, is to focus too much on the elegantly and persuasively, and not enough on the fact that they have to have something to say first. There is no point in teaching your students how to express somebody else's thoughts well, because if they're reading somebody else's thoughts, they've already been expressed better than they can express them if they're 16 years old. Given this, I'm going to try to explain what we do and why we do it. Not in any way, shape, or form as a, here is a model to plug and play. Absolutely cannot happen. You can't plug and play this. If we take seriously the idea that's been thrown around a couple of times here already, that the well-trained student is like his teacher, you can't implement my rhetoric unless you're me. And you can't be me until you've been my student. And that's just not going to happen. Although I have some students in here who have expressed a desire to do that. Tell them, don't. It's not worth it. Actually, it is worth it, but I can't tell her that. So what do we do? Rhetoric class at Cary Christian School is not a field of study. We are not studying a body of knowledge. It is not merely a public speaking course. This is the best definition I could come up with. The rhetoric course is that time and place where Cary Christian School students experience intellectual discord and often cognitive dissonance and respond with authentic belief communicated effectively. That's what I'm trying to do. The end result has generally been articulate and poised individuals willing and able to communicate with the world that exists today. I don't set out to present 2 years of public speaking in the hopes that at the end of those 2 years, they will stand up and wow their peers and parents at their senior thesis defense. And hopefully we'll have time to talk about that later. But the senior thesis defense for our students is generally given to anywhere from 200 to 250 people, top of a very large stage. And this year they did it from memory. And then they were mercilessly grilled by a very astute faculty who have visions of being the next American Idol judges and behave accordingly. I decided to test this theory, and using Facebook, I sent out a call to all Cary Christian School graduates, and I said, please private message me a definition of, quote, Mr. Pitt's rhetoric class, end quote. I wanted to see, once they're done, what do they say? I'm happy. Because most of them say something like this. I shouldn't do this, but you might enjoy it. And I won't name names. Mr. Pitts' rhetoric class. Hey, Mr. Pitts. Well, I'm not sure what type of answer you're looking for, or if you even still need another. I'm sure you've gotten plenty already. Also, I'm sure my insight will be nowhere near profound. But I would define your class as, well, actually, I don't know that I can give it a definition as easily as a description. But, great. Your class was more than educating, it was enlightening. It allowed everyone who was ever going to take an interest enough to make an effort to learn to think. It helped me to really think about so many things that actually matter and get out of the mindless way of life that's so easy to live. And I think it provided an objectivity that's hard to come by. It seems to me that it was a success in that it was, I guess, advancing and actuating. I have no idea what that means. You couldn't not grow in some way just by virtue of being awake in the class, whether for better or for worse. But I think more often for better. It forced choices, ones that would be made inevitably just by living, but it made some of them happen in a time and a way that was close to ideal. I hope that makes sense to you the way it does in my mind. It was definitely challenging intellectually, but also morally, and very interesting, not to mention enjoyable. Honestly, I don't really know how to accurately define your class. Maybe that's why you're asking. All I know is that it was absolutely wonderful. I realize that's very specific, and I'm sorry. I hope that in some way helpful. If not, I'm sorry for the time it took you to read all that. And if that was really what you were asking and you have more specific questions, let me know. Now, this particular student and I had a great deal of fun over 2 years where she would get up and talk and talk, and I'd say, I'm going to try not to use her name. She'd talk to her and I'd say, stop. Just say it. She'd take a deep breath. Okay. Well, it was kind of like, stop. Just say it. And by the end of senior year, I could get an answer out of her. And it took 2 years. Now, that was not a great speech. It was not eloquent. Some sentences had no meaning whatsoever. But it was an improvement. And it also justifies my belief that what we're doing in rhetoric is trying to give them something to say and then helping them to communicate that. In brief, what do? 2 years, 4 quarters in each year. Quarter number one, Plato's worldview. We look at Plato in many different dialogues with the intention of understanding how Plato views the world affects how Plato views words. There's a very direct connection between Plato's idealism and how he thinks we ought to go about talking. He doesn't mind the philosopher with his head in the clouds as long as he's after the truth. And that only makes sense if you accept Plato's idea of truth and of knowledge. So we take a good bit of time to see that connection between viewing the world and viewing your use of language as part of that world. We then turn to Aristotle. We read the majority of the rhetoric. We study it. We say, let us sit at Aristotle's feet and soak up everything that we possibly can from this. We'll judge later, but we can't judge till we know. We can't say, oh, Aristotle, either good, either bad. We have to know it. So we take the time to know it. We practice exercising these artistic forms of persuasion. They draw emotions out of a hat and have to pull that emotion out of their audience. everybody puts a politician or a famous personage in a hat, and they have to draw it out and praise or censure them. We go through a classical rhetoric course to glean from it what we can. And it is a we. I'm not gleaning and giving it to them. They're gleaning. Some of them, by the time we're done with Plato and Aristotle, don't like Plato at all. And they say, Aristotle's the man. This makes sense to me. I can go with this. And other people are saying, that's insane. Aristotle's nothing but a very early pragmatist. I don't need that. Give me the idealism. Once we're done looking at these two, we practice. First, we practice with Luther and Calvin, two essays that they both wrote dealing with secular authority. And we analyze them in an Aristotelian fashion. We analyze them in a Platonic fashion. And then we drop the big old, what would God actually maybe perhaps say about this? We spend some time digging deeply into arguments that are explicitly made. Luther and Calvin are trying to persuade a particular audience to do a particular thing at a particular time. And we analyze it. We ask how well they're successful at it. We try to argue with them. We try to defend them. We then do something a little more difficult, and we look at arguments made in stories. We start with Aesop's Fables. It's very simple. There's the fable. What's the message? Not a problem. We go through those very quickly. We got the fable. And we go on to the folk tale. We read these great old folk tales, find really nice old musty books with old versions of the folk tale in them, read them, say, extract the argument. A little more difficult, but not that bad. We move our way up complexity until we get to George MacDonald's Lilith. And that serves as our ultimate impossible to discern the argument being made, although one is clearly being made. The entire story is one long argument for universal salvation. The kids have no idea. They work. They struggle. What is he saying? And they'll say, I know he's saying something, but I cannot figure it out. And we work and say, he is trying to convince you to hold a belief that every single one of your pastors is going to denounce as heretical. And he gets a lot of you. How did he do it? Arguments and persuasion don't just come in the essays. Like, this story is a remarkable example of an argument for something that's generally considered heretical. And then the students beg at the end, please, Mr. Pitts, tell us why it's wrong. Tell it, because it really looks right. Why is it wrong? Why is it wrong? They go, go talk to your pastor. He'll tell you why it's wrong. Lilith. I don't want to undersell the fact that it's strange, it's problematic. When George MacDonald was writing it, and it was one of the last books he wrote, his wife read an early draft, and she was horrified at him. It's dark. And she begged him, please not to finish, to just put it away. He handed it to one of his sons. His son said, no, it's absolutely brilliant. You have to finish it. So read it before you order it. Junior thesis in the fourth quarter. I have a problem that it's a good problem to have, but it's probably unlike many of your problems. I have 120 rhetoric students. Does anybody else have 120 rhetoric students? One. He's my boss. When I had 15 juniors, the junior thesis was a lovely, lovely time of us all sitting around our computers and writing 15 lovely papers and taking 2.5 months to do it. It was beautiful, lovely, great, loved it. There's 60 of them now. It's impossible. So what I did was I picked one topic. We all do that one topic. The junior thesis is a training ground. I teach them what it's like to actually master a topic, how to organize the paper, how to construct the arguments, how to cite sources. We're going to put added emphasis on that next year. Then their senior thesis, they choose on their own. And many students in the school start working on their senior thesis sometime around 8th or 9th grade, when they start witnessing the senior thesis defenses and they start thinking about them then. Rhetoric 2 is the application of the theory that we have talked about in year 1 to two basic collections of work. One that largely deals with questions of epistemology, the other with authority. And the reason behind this, aside from them being the thinkers being the seminal thinkers in the Western tradition, it's these are the two areas that they are most likely to debate with roommates and college professors. How do we justify claims that we make, and to whom ought we to submit, and why? So we spend time there. The summary here is show the students the connection between your assumptions and what you do with words. Show how words have been interpreted. Ask them to apply that theory to works. Evaluate the theory in practice. And then finally, try to answer the question, on what day of the week did Jesus die? And defend it. In Rhetoric 2, we keep doing the same things. We just do it on different authors. Throughout the rhetoric sequence, we are practicing our rhetorical skills. Don't get me wrong. The ability to stand up and coherently, cogently, and sometimes on the fly, make a decent showing of yourself and your ideas is very necessary, and they practice this daily. Iron sharpens iron, and the students sharpen each other fairly well at this point. And then when they're not strong enough, I step in and sharpen some more. Third quarter senior, they write their thesis, they defend it in the fourth quarter, and then generally we pick one or two books that we would like to do some in-depth work on and finish out the year that way. You cannot plug and play this. The hope is that if this makes any sense, it's given you some direction to look at it and say, I am not going to do that. That looks insane. Or, no, I reject the fundamental premise of the course. We are doing a public speaking because we're doing all this other stuff in our philosophy class, which may be a very legitimate objection. We divide things differently. For us, rhetoric is a capstone. It's a polishing. It is not a content course. We could cover a lot of rhetorical theory in 2 years if that's all that we were doing. But I don't believe we would have students that can think quite as well if we did that. Might they be more eloquent? Yes. But might they be eloquent with cliches? Yes. And what's the good of that? Like I said at the beginning, when they ask for an outline in the winter for what is going to be said in the summer. You turn in a very broad outline. Say, I know I can talk about some of this stuff. The rest of those points in the outline, the rhetorical tools. I have an outline here. Assignments, evaluations, the theses. I've decided to de-emphasize those in terms of time, in terms of the trying to explain why we're doing what we're doing, the questions that we have. Anyone who is in here, who is teaching at a rhetoric level, can construct tests, quizzes, and assignments. You can put together a syllabus. You've done it before, you'll do it again. The question of, well, why am I choosing to do this, is what I was hoping to probe and to pry. The one thing that I would like to, in the remaining few minutes, to deal with, if I can skip ahead here, rhetorical tools, types of assignments, evaluations. Quizzes, very simply, are short, objective, grammar-level knowledge things. I grabbed a couple off the computer. I'm a giant mess here. A quiz question. According to Descartes, what is the principal cause of human heterogeneity in thought? Remember this quiz, Lily? Can you answer that question? She just graduated. It's less than a year ago. According to Descartes, what is the principal cause of human heterogeneity in thought? I told you I was going to call on you. How many of you in here have actually read Descartes' Meditations? Oh, that's no good. All right, well, let's pretend that many of you raised your hand, and then I asked you this question, and you said, I don't know. That having happened, that's normal. You can't answer that question unless you read it last night. Quizzes, you know, tests the application of all these rhetorical skills within a time constraint. That, for me, that's what a test is. Can you apply something in a limited amount of time? So I don't believe it's ever appropriate to have a grammar-level test in rhetoric. Use them in the quizzes, by all means. But why in the world, if you're making a major test, would you simply be asking them to regurgitate knowledge to you? Writing. It's the same thing as a test. They just have longer to do it. Can you apply it? Speeches for me are a little different. Trying to grade both performance and content is too much for me. It might not be too much for you. Please knock yourselves out. I can't do it. When students give speeches, I will grade their performance. If I want to grade the content, I'll say, turn in a written copy for me, and I'll deal with the content there. But the speeches, when they are serving as an evaluation, are an evaluation of their performance. The big question here, to rubric or not to rubric. I've got a doozy of a rubric that I once created. It's really cool. It's great. It's got all kinds of explanations and here for content, style, grammar and mechanics, formatting. This is what it takes to get an A in content or a B in style, and then you put it all together, and here's the algorithm that produces a grade. If there were a trash can up here, I'd crumple this up and throw it in it because I used it once and said, that doesn't work for me. Maybe you can use them effectively. What it seemed to me to be doing was to try and take something that is inherently artistic, turn it into a set of numbers, and say, aha, you have achieved an 88.3 on this paper. And when a parent comes in and says, well, why is it not an 88.4? I have no good answer. I can bluff. I'm a rhetoric teacher. I can make up answers on the fly. I can make it sound good. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But truth be said, no, I can't justify it. So, what I've turned to is a rubric of sorts put together by the Derek Bok Center for Teaching and Learning at Harvard. And it's very simple and wonderful. The unsatisfactory paper. The DRFP paper either has no thesis or else it has one that is strikingly vague, broad, or uninteresting. There's little indication that the writer understands material being presented. The paragraphs do not hold together. Ideas do not develop from sentence to sentence. This paper usually repeats the same thoughts again and again, perhaps in slightly different language, but often with the same words. The DRF paper is filled with mechanical faults, error in grammar, and errors in spelling. With that kind of description, it is very easy to identify a failing paper. Likewise, a description of an A paper. The A paper has all the good qualities of the B paper, but in addition, it is lively, well-paced, interesting, even exciting. The paper has style. Everything in it seems to fit the thesis exactly. It may have a proofreading error, too, or even a misspelled word, but the reader feels that these errors are the consequence of the normal accidents all good writers encounter. Reading the paper, we can feel a mind at work. We are convinced that the writer cares for his or her ideas and about the language that carries them. The sure mark of an A paper is that you will find yourself telling someone else about it. It is also very easy to identify that paper. So I've moved away from attempting to mechanize the grading in rhetoric class and created these descriptions and said, it is an excellent piece of work. It is a well above average piece of work. Or it is perfectly acceptable for credit here at Cary Christian School work. The kids sometimes don't like this. But what it does seem to force them to do is to take a more holistic approach to their writing, because they look and say, oh, that's what it was. I'm looking on the rubric here, and I got a 3 on this. So all I have to do to be an A writer is to bring that 3 up to a 5, when generally that is not the case. So I've gone away from rubrics and said, look, here is a standard of genuine excellence. And nobody that doesn't meet the standard actually thinks that they do. They read the standard and they say, yeah, you're right. It's not that. The final section of the outline, the miscellanies, the teacher and the rhetoric school in general. Since every school is different, every rhetoric class is going to be different. It just is. There is no one way that this could possibly be done. It depends on who the other teachers are, what they're doing, how well you're able to integrate, what you're able to integrate, the competencies of the other teachers. At Cary Christian, I don't have to spend a lot of time teaching kids how to stand behind a podium, because they stand behind a podium in every class from seventh grade on. I don't have to teach them an awful lot about writing. Mrs. Crea pulls her hair out for that for me. And there is an English teacher teaching basic composition, and I can do more. If you're the rhetoric teacher, it would be helpful if everyone in the rhetoric school had a shared vision of what the rhetoric school was actually doing. And that will kind of help direct what it is that you're doing. Or if you're the administrator, clarify to everybody what the rhetoric school is all about. And I think I'm past time, so, and I promise to be done early.
It's no good. Thank you, and enjoy your dinner.